Hey there, everyone, and welcome to today's episode of Beyond the Rock podcast. I'm your host, Emily Hernandez, and my co-host, Jeremy, and I are pumped to share one of the last episodes of the year. Today's guest is California native and proud Austin resident, Vincent Pham. You can typically find Vince at our local crags on a very consistent basis. His bright red helmet, gregarious personality, and wild whippers tend to catch the attention of others. Vince is a great climber and a thoughtful human being. He's methodical with his preparation and training, and at the same time, he's super appreciative for the community he surrounds himself with. I think we can all agree we are very fortunate to be rock climbers. There's something about this adventurous lifestyle that attracts people who like to think deeper, push harder, and really connect with what climbing brings to our lives. Okay, enough of my sappy opinions. Let's get this show going. Woo, cheers. What's going on, Vince? How are ya?
Good, good. Just got off the Urban Assault route with my buddy Ryan. Probably you guys have met him before at Crux or so. And it was his first time on the multi-pitch. Emily, you guys, or both you guys, Jeremy, have you guys been on it?
I have not, no.
Okay.
So I've heard of it.
I'm a boulderer.
Yes, yes, I know that. I know that, yes.
It's not like I don't talk about it like every episode, right?
Exactly. It's such a cool extra perspective for everyone to kind of bounce different ideas from both of you guys.
For sure.
Different type of climbers.
Yeah, and one thing that we do discuss is why Austin is such a unique place to climb. So considering you literally just got off of a limestone multi-pitch in the middle of the city, do you mind sharing with our audience what that's like after you introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Vincent Pham. A lot of people call me Vince. Jeez, I was originally born in California, migrated around for a lot of my schooling through Michigan and New York. Left like, I don't know, 15, 16 years ago from California and just wanted to move to Austin. Not for the rock, actually.
Well, what was it for? For the music? You're a musician too, right?
I've been in a couple bands and recorded stuff, but man, you know when you kind of taper off of that New York scene?
No, not at all. I'm Texan.
Where did you live in New York?
In the city, in Brooklyn.
Okay.
I do know New Yorkers, though.
Yeah.
They're a unique breed.
They are neat. I think a lot of them are getting a little nicer, too, at least the ones that I've met. But I wanted to move here just for, I don't know, it was maybe I drove through and my cousins showed me Rainy Street and they showed me this place that you play volleyball at a bar. I'm blanking out on the name of it, though.
Could be any of those bars down on Rainy Street.
Yeah. You play volleyball. There, Aussies was one of those spots, and then they showed me Sixth Street, and I just love the vibe and the friendliness.
So you're a fairly recent transplant. If it's Rainy Street, that's only been like 5-6 years, right?
Yeah, I moved here in 2014, so six years or so.
Yeah, so we moved here from New York, from Long Island, and yeah, it's a little bit of decompression, right? Because everybody in New York's kind of high strung.
Hold on a minute. Aren't you from Michigan?
I am from Michigan, but my wife is from Long Island, and we moved from Michigan to Austin, and Austin to Long Island, and then back to Austin.
Oh man!
So I was actually here once when Austin was this big, was a tiny town, a tiny-ish town, and now it's a huge city.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So yeah, how did you discover climbing, and then yeah, give us that timeline.
Okay, so one part of my training after after Michigan, I went into a program for 1 year in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And that's where it all went down. There was a girl there that was 1 year ahead of me from my school. And I was like, oh, I think she's really cute. And I find out that she's a climber. I have 1 year in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And so I just follow her to the climbing gym. And that's it, man. You know, we belayed each other. She taught me how to lead climb indoors. And then we started, as you know, New Mexico's got a lot of good good stuff around it. So we went to the Jemez and Socorro and some places I can't even remember the names of. Such a long time ago, like 11, 12 years ago. But that's where the climbing bug started coming in. And I think, I wonder if like, I just got my hands got exposed earlier in my life. So maybe it kind of like translates to a decade later when I start climbing again, like maybe some of my forearm cells like remember like, hey, it's okay to like, you know, try to really hold hard or something like that. Like I kind of think of it as like if you learn how to skateboard or something as a kid, then you kind of just never forget. Maybe that gave me a little bit of that little bit of advantage because I got a little bit earlier exposure.
Are you saying that you got that exposure before your time in New Mexico? Or was there
New Mexico, okay. My early exposure time. And then maybe like, I don't know, 8 years later, I'm here starting to climb again because of ABP.
That's Austin Bouldering Project. For those who don't know, another great Austin gym.
That's a little slice of heaven, man. It's so good. And then just fell in love with it again.
Well, great. Have you explored any other parts of Texas climbing?
Yeah, little itty bitties, Continental Ranch. Camp Eagle, which a lot of people don't know about. I don't know if you guys know about it.
I have heard about it and did see some photos of you out there. I think Ryan as well. Was he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
I don't want to tell everybody about it.
Oh, got it.
No, I'm just kidding. I mean, Camp Eagle is a kid's camp. It's an awesome camp.
Yeah.
But it's only open to the public sometimes.
Okay.
We took advantage of that. A lot of the pandemic, they couldn't have the kids there in the beginning.
Yeah.
So they opened it up to the public and we went like every other week. Lots of limestone routes, 8, 10, 12 bolts, maybe like 35 routes. Fun for the family, 5'7" all the way to 5'12" or so. It's really cool.
Nice.
And it's a beautiful place. I mean, it runs along, can't remember what river it is, but there's like rope swings and slides and all that good stuff, you know?
Yeah, I did. I know through the pictures that you do have on Facebook, which is something that I do enjoy as your friend and Facebook friend, is that you definitely share your experiences in climbing. And I really enjoy, I know it sounds silly, I always want you to be safe, but man, I love watching you take whippers. You are so brave. Oh my gosh.
It was the whole, maybe it was a couple years ago. I was like, it seems like everything on Facebook is just glamorized.
It is.
It's really sure, like yeah. All the best things are happening on Facebook and everyone's living a better life. And I was like, oh, what if I just took a little bit of a different position and just posted my failures all the time? And so almost exclusively everything on Facebook. I post once every other month or something like that, but it's just me falling down all the time. I don't think I've ever posted a send video because I think it's kind of funny to just fall and grunt and scream and fall again.
Did you submit a video to Rock and Ice for Weekend Whipper, or did a friend of yours
submit
it for you?
I wonder, were you the one that suggested it? Someone suggested it.
I don't know, maybe. But there was one that you took a whip that was longer than Jade. I mean, it was
long, that's for sure.
I
didn't know about soft catches at the time. Or I knew about them, but I didn't know the proper time to apply them,
you know? Okay, so let's talk about that. Soft catches versus hard catches. When you're going for it, what did you learn about why soft catches are great?
So I learned from, I think, one of the posts that's our buddy Eric Demo posted, mm-hmm. Like, oh, you should really consider taking a soft catch right there. Yeah, he said, hey, you should probably you should definitely take a soft catch there. And here's my incorrect, what I didn't know at the time. I'd always thought the soft catch was because I didn't want my harness to jolt me upon falling.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, when you fall, it feels like really like when you hit your harness and the rope, you know, gets snug and taut, then it hurts my hip. That's what I thought the soft catch was all about. And I was like, I don't care about that. I've never felt like anyone caught me too hard. Mm. As a matter of fact, I mean, just chatting with Eric a little bit and just reading more about it, it's much less about hitting hard on the bottom of the rope. More so, it's important that it doesn't rocket swing you into the wall. And so that's, I definitely learned it from Jade, because I was limping on my right heel.
And I saw that before I read the thread, I did see that when you whipped, slammed into it, and your body positioning was good, but I saw that your right foot took the brunt of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
A hard catch. Yeah. Story that a friend, I don't know if you know Doug McDowell.
Yeah, for sure.
So he had a hard catch. I think it was at Red Rock, and he slammed into a bolt and his foot hit a bolt. Yeah, you should ask him about it. It was pretty gnarly.
You guys ever see that video where Sharma falls and takes a bolt to the chin?
Oh, no.
Oh, my gosh.
Hold on. Stitch him up and gets back on. Pretty sure it was Sharma.
I think I remember that one. I think I remember that video. Super overhung route, maybe like in Bishop area or something. Anyways.
Could be.
Yeah, that's cool. Good thing though, I just ran into Doug at Sex Canyon this weekend.
So yeah, he's got some projects over there.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and so circling just back to the beginning of this conversation, since you are well-traveled, you have been exposed to great out-of-state locations here in the U.S., what makes Austin so different?
Oh, man. I think first and foremost, like we have a crag in our backyard, we all do, which is the Greenbelt. And I was just there at Urban Assault, and I'm there every Tuesday and Thursday for the most part, because I have no other friends or no other life, which is great.
Climbing is life, man. Come on, right. We know that.
Yeah, I'm at Gus and New Wall quite a bit. That's gotta be one of the favorite things too. Be able to say, hey, you're at work, right? And you're texting your friends like, hey, does anyone want to climb at 4:30? And then you get to the crag and you climb for 4 hours or something, 3 or 4 hours. A lot of us got lights nowadays that are totally affordable now, right? And pretty strong. So we're climbing through the winter, no problem. And so you climb on a Tuesday after work for 4 hours, and you think about some of the other people in the world that have to they have to wait for a weekend, or they have to wait for a trip to fly out to do, or, you know, they have to drive on a Saturday a couple hours, 2-3 hours, to climb for 4 or 5 hours and then drive back 3-4 hours again, you know? And yet we do that after work. It's so unfair. We're so blessed, for sure.
We really are. So, you know, limestone versus Enchanted Rock pink granite versus the limestone at Continental Ranch on the Pecos River. What's your favorite? It's not a trick question.
Yeah. Sandstone's my favorite. I think at heart I'm a sport climber. I really like it. And that kind of just gives that texture and doesn't have the polish, and is Horseshoe Canyon. But don't get me wrong, I will battle to the end defending limestone, even size. You know, because I just love it. It just gives us so much. Like, now I know how to place my feet well, and I know how to trust it, you know, and I know how to take as much mechanical advantage of every curve of the hold because it's more polished and stuff. And so a lot of times, I'm not sure if you guys said this before or feel this as well, but like when you travel, you just feel like, well, I'm a pretty darn strong climber when I'm not in
Greenbelt
or Austin.
Never, no, definitely. Never had that feeling.
I don't know. I feel the exact opposite. That's a firm no.
I always think I'm doing really good, and then I go out to Waco, and then I'm like, oh no, time to go back home.
I think if I was at like Crux or ABP a lot more, then I would feel that. Because I feel like sometimes, yeah. I guess they go in waves. Sometimes it feels a little bit like chill, but that rings true, I think, for most gyms, you know.
Yeah, ABP of all the gyms in town, I've climbed at ABP the most, and I would say ABP does definitely go in waves. Like, it's harder sometimes, and then it's easier. And I don't know if that's on purpose or just happens that way.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I agree.
And I would also say, and this is not a dig on them because it's their business is to get people in the door. But I would say that ABP is a little bit softer than almost any other gym that I've ever been in. When it's at its like softest, and then when it goes up, it's kind of on par with everything else that I've been to. But yeah, so anyway, me and my buddy, like we climbed for like 6 months at ABP, just noobs, right? And then went out to Waco and got spanked a little. Well, I got spanked a little. My buddy did all right. But he did parkour for 6 years before we started climbing.
I got spanked on my first time in Waco, and my second and my third.
Me too.
Did you guys love it? You guys loved it, I'm sure, right?
It's unbelievable. Yeah. I mean,
I love Waco.
Renders you speechless.
It's literally my favorite place on earth.
You feel the energy from the land, and you look around and just, you can only imagine because of what you see, what life was like back then. And you look at people like Jason Kale, who have dedicated almost their, you know, majority of their life to developing that area and encouraging others to protect it, begging others to respect it. So it's a very special place for sure.
The desert's just amazing. Like,
yeah,
I got to go out there. I got to get out of my, sport climbing shoes and my sport climbing boots, whatever, and make my way out there. Sure.
Well, you know, speaking of climbing, Eric Horst focused on peak performance for rock climbing, and he is an author of many, many, many training books. So what I wanted to know, Vince, since you are such a dedicated climber, do you have any kind of regimen that you follow? Or, you know, I know you focus a lot on health and wellness for yourself and for others. So what does that look like for you?
I climb 4 days a week.
Okay.
Tuesday, Thursday, and the weekends. I would probably end up wanting to climb more, but I think that recovery is important at my stage. I think if you're elite like Adam Andra, then maybe 6 days a week is what he does or something. But I climb almost exclusively outdoors unless the rain doesn't permit it, because I just love the outdoors. I love the cold. I love the hot. I love the air, the sun, the everything about it, the mosquitoes, the dirt. I'm a fan. Jeremy's like, whatever. Keep me.
Dude, we were down at McKinney like a month and a half ago, and it was like mosquitoes, like flies in the air. It was crazy. Oh, I mean, gosh. We still climbed.
Like you were like as if you were outside or something.
Yeah, like it was way too much nature. That's what I said last time I was out of Reimers. I'm like, it's too naturey out here. I gotta go.
Okay. Back to your
training wise, it's really hard because I enjoy climbing so much. But I do hangboard, and I hangboard 10 minutes after my Tuesday and Thursday climbs. And that's about it. If you go online on Google, you look up 10-minute hangboard, it's on there. With Metolius writes it for beginners, intermediates, or advanced. And I just do the intermediate one because I'm fine with doing the advanced one. I think it's really hard, but mentally it's too taxing for me to think that I'm going to go home after enjoying climbing and really just brutalize myself on the wall for 10 minutes on the hangboard for 10 minutes. So I could, my mind could accept 10 minutes of intermediate hangboarding way more. And that could keep me consistent. You know what I mean? Versus like doing like a really hard one for a real long time, once a month, which doesn't really, I don't think it really adds up too much if you're just doing it like that inconsistently.
And so why after your session as opposed to before?
Because I go straight from work. I go straight from work to the green belt. After the green belt, I go straight from work to the green belt. After the green belt, I come straight home and then I hangboard from there. But I'm also warmed up and I don't feel that. I just started hangboarding last year and I felt intimidated by it because I'm pretty anti-injury and I try to make a conscious effort to pay attention to potentially injuring yourself. So I was kind of nervous about jumping into the hangboard in the first place, but I need warming up. I'm a huge, huge believer in in warming up. Not all my friends do. They go straight to their projects right away. Knock on wood, but I haven't had any major injuries yet, and the progress is going pretty good.
So what does a warm-up for you look like? Talk to me about how your morning starts from when you get up in the morning to when you tie your first figure eight follow through.
Oh, so I guess I'll tell you a weekday, a standard like green belt day. I'll wake up at 7. I will do all my morning stuff. I'll fast a little bit, eat my first meal at 11. But in the morning before I drive off, I'll do around 3 to 5 minutes of yoga pretty consistently, hitting everything from head to toe, you know, arms and legs, every range of motion that I know. Let's see, hit work during lunch hour, I do another 3 to 5 minutes of yoga, and then I do a calisthenics, gymnastics strength training workout for like 30 minutes during lunch, and then finish the day at work, zip over to the green belt, meet up with all my friends. I'm sure you'd recognize like half of them or more, because the Austin climbing community is super amazing. And just, you know, up climb, down climb, a 5'9" or something. Maybe do that on a 5'11A through the looking glass, up and down climb it, feel pretty warmed up, and then hit some of the 12s after that, some of the projects after that.
So your warm up starts when your day starts, is kind of what you are referring to, or what you're alluding to, maybe?
I guess so. I'm a big fan of range of motion and tissue adaptation and resilience. So I like trying to make sure I hit all the ranges of motion and just making sure not just my tissues are comfortable with it, but my brain is comfortable with it throughout the years too. You know, I'm definitely not 20 years old anymore. So I got to maintain those things or else your body forgets and your mind forgets and it feels stiff and tight, you know?
So on your non-green belt days, do you do any like cross training or are those just recovery days?
Every day at lunchtime, I'll usually do a body weight calisthenics exercise for like 30 minutes or something. It might look like yoga, but it's called gymnastic strength training. You'll add some body weight thing that seems pretty hard. And then the other half of it, when you take a break from it, is between sets, you'll do mobility work.
Cool.
I like all that stuff. I like all that stuff because it serves me in other ways, like climbing and just my life. But I don't like it in itself. I don't like power lifting or Olympic lifting in itself. It's not fun or it's not my goal, but I'll use it as a tool to give me strength for the things I do really like, which is climbing and stuff, hiking or whatever.
I'm going to ask you a woo-woo-y question.
Woo-woo.
What does climbing bring to your life?
There was this one time I listened to this interview with Alex Honnold and someone asked him something like that. Like, what has climbing given you? And his answer is way better than mine. But what he said was, he kind of like, yeah, that's a good question. I don't really know, but I think I can't answer that because climbing is giving me everything.
In
my life, yeah.
I feel like I heard that sound bite.
Yeah. So I didn't climb my entire life or even half of it, but climbing is definitely giving me the community, which is, I love this community so much. I do believe what Tommy said. I'm pretty sure Tommy said that, and I've heard it from a lot of my friends, and a lot of us travel and climb and come back and say like, wow, this community is really awesome. It's different. It is unique still for some. Can you guys explain it? Can you guys give me a little bit of tidbits on why Austin's climb? Is it small? Is it just the city's vibe? What's going on here that makes this climb community so awesome compared to Colorado, or I don't even know.
It's not even that it's small. I guess I've never been in any other climbing community, but you were talking about going to the Green Belt and like being able, like if we were down there, we'd probably recognize some of the people. And it's kind of weird because I started hiking a little bit. And so I was just hiking back and forth on the green belt over by the Whipping Post Boulder. But so I don't know what wall that is over there.
Yeah, that's
the post. The post.
That's Gus Frew.
And so I was like, yeah, I'll bomb up there and see. It's probably somebody I know sport climbing. I didn't know anybody. And I was like, oh, okay. But, you know, so like I have this group of people that I know, this circle, but I guess it's bigger. You know, obviously the climbing community is bigger than that.
You know, we've spoken to Selena Pang, Tommy Blackwell, who were in the climbing scene 20 years ago, and we read James Crump and Phil Horton about how the scene is different. And maybe what makes us unique is the appreciation for the accessibility in a state like Texas, when this type of activity, kind of like when the guys started developing Joe's Valley, people look at us like, what in the hell are y'all doing? What is this? Why would we consider letting you on our land? And so maybe just how niche it is and kind of sets us apart from any other athletic endeavor. And I don't know, my heart's kind of pounding even just thinking about it, because I don't know where I would be without this community. And I'm not sure if I would have felt that way in Colorado, because when you go out there, it just, I guess like some of the higher traffic areas, it just feels a lot more serious sometimes, like at the red, you know, people fighting for routes, people kind of not talking nice to each other. So I don't know if that's because of the grades that they're pushing, because I haven't traveled a whole lot outside of Texas. But I don't know. Does that, any of that make sense? Or
it does.
All of it.
I think the other thing I would say is, if you're climbing outside in the Austin area, you're a different kind of crazy. Like, just everything, I mean, no joke, like everything is hard here. Like, I see some of my friends climbing in, you know, in Tennessee or in Arkansas or something, and they're climbing a V0 where it's literally, it's got a jug. And like, and then I go down to this, I have a V0 project at McKinney that goes from a crappy slope or to like two razor blade crimps, and then you go to the top, and that's a V0. So,
oh man, there's this route. I've been working its project at, it's called Pollution Erosion at Insanity Wall at Reimers. But the first move is, gosh, one of the hardest moves. I took it off in mountain project. Like, geez, it's so tendony.
Oh my.
I wouldn't be surprised if I just pulled something on that first, just the beginning of the move. It's so brutal. But anyways.
Yeah, no, I don't know anything about that because I don't start on routes like that, but I support my friends who do. So
I just don't climb anything like that, period.
What else is really cool is that, like for instance, for that route, I was trying to figure out if I'm going a little off route by going a little left. And so I hit up Tommy Blackwell, who connected me with a guy named Chris something. And then also I kind of went into Mountain Project, found out who the first ascensionist was, and like, oh, Long Ta. Like, yeah, I've already hit him up about other things. Like, it's so cool because we could actually talk to the first ascensionist here, or the bolters, and feel pretty darn comfortable about it. I feel pretty lucky on a regular basis, you know, having this type of crew of climbers around us in Austin.
So you agree that our trailblazers are easily accessible?
We're kind of a big deal. We're kind of the best.
I mean, yeah, you look at Enchanted Rock, which is the beautiful pink granite dome in Fredericksburg, Texas, and it is where we can trad climb. So it is an amazing property. And you look at what they put up and you just think, how in the hell did they make it down in one piece? Have you spent any time out at Enchanted Rock?
Yeah, we're gonna go this weekend, this whole weekend. But yeah, that's where I kind of cut my teeth on learning some trad. I would consider myself still a beginner, but I feel very solid as a beginner. I've done lots of the 7s, 8s, and 9s. I'm yet to get my first 10 minus lead.
Okay.
Should be Texas Crude or what's that one on Carnivore Boulders called? Top Choice. Are you familiar with those?
I have not been on them, but yes, the names.
I just think that they're, I might not be, I can climb them and top rope them fine, but I'm starting to get a lot more comfortable with my placements.
Good.
And so I feel like, hey, it's okay to take, you know. I haven't fallen or taken, I don't think, yet, but I think I should start pushing that edge. But I like being really safe when it comes to trad. So sport climbing, I'll fly all over the place and whip and stuff like that. But with trad, I'm a lot safer. I think with sport, I'm actually really safe and boring and conservative as well, but I'll whip for sure on sport.
Well, I think that you have really great body awareness, which is why when you whip, I feel like you have a good idea of where you are on the wall and also how your body moves to be able to receive that momentum.
Thanks. Yeah, I feel like I've talked recently with my buddy Jeff about this, but he's gotten really comfortable with leading all the time now, even on any route, any high project for him. I think we both agreed that once you kind of like, you look at the route and see where the bolts are placed and see what bulges out and what might be potentially hazardous. Once you kind of have an idea of if I fall, it's going to be totally clean. You can't just automatically do that though. You can't just as a beginner say, oh, I saw the pros whip, so I could whip anywhere I want. You kind of have to go through the trials and tribulations and kind of experience it, but then also like pay attention that, oh yeah, that's totally fine to whip. Other times it's like, oh, I feel really sketchy. On pollution erosion yesterday, Jeff and I were staring up at that route and looking at the bolts. And I was like, I don't want to high clip that because it's so taxing. Mm-hmm. So I might just dead point above it. But if I do dead point above it, if I miss that, am I going to whip down? That's fine if I whip down, but am I going to slam my knees into the little roof? Because when there's a roof, there's air underneath the roof and your feet want to catch the wall on the whip, but there's nothing there because it's the roof. Then your knees could slam in the wall. So we stared at that together. And I like Jeff's assessments. I trust his assessments. And it's kind of good that both of us kind of just stood there. We really just looking at it like, hey, if I hit the dead point, I'm fine. If I don't hit the dead point, my harness will be, you know, 4 feet above the last bolt, etc. And then I'll fall this much. Should we give a soft catch so that we kind of go under the knees that don't slam the wall? Or should we give a hard catch so that we slam into the wall really hard, but don't hit the roof lip or something like that? Now, I feel like this is a conversation that it's really boring for people to hear and talk about. It's kind of technical stuff. It's kind of boring, nerdy stuff, you know?
Well, I feel like climbers are nerds and our audience has a high concentration of outdoor climbers, which is what I try to remind people is that climbing did start outdoors. And I love that climbing gyms are available to us and that we're so fortunate to have so many. And I wanted to ask, when someone comes into the climbing world or they see a video or they watch a movie and they get really excited about it, how do you recommend they get into climbing?
I guess the easiest thing to say is definitely hit up a gym. I think ABP is such a great spot. It's almost flawless unless you don't pay attention and just hang out underneath, you know, the overhangs, which I think happens a little bit more these days because that place was really crowded before the pandemic. Otherwise, though, I could totally imagine some of my friends that might be a little bit athletic and love the outdoors, like, hey, yeah, just come out straight with me to Gus Frew, and we'll start off on Guide's Wall, and you'll feel comfortable going on this, or mentally you'll feel comfortable going on this 5-6. That sounds super easy, but then it's gonna mess them up because it's freaking Gus Frew and it's super
right. Awesome. It's like it's all limestone this polished.
Yeah, but it's super pretty, and you could take some awesome pictures of them and kind of just get them stoked. Another thing, actually, that earlier question you were asking about what's climbing given us, I think a really simple one that I overlooked aside from the community and the physical challenge, the creativity of the physical challenge, to be able to look at a route and try to figure out the puzzle and then get on the route and execute the body movements to execute that puzzle that your mind decided and then to adapt on the spot because you're wrong. You know, your mind wasn't correct in sequencing it all the time. I love all that stuff, but I kind of, there's a movie called Dirtbag with Fred Becky. Mm-hmm. And I kind of love Fred Becky for being who he was, because he kind of carved and paved this idea in a lot of our minds that, you know what, life could be really simple. we don't even need to make money. We don't even need to work a job. I mean, granted, I work a job and I'm very happy there. And I think most of us should, but just that we don't have to strive to like, we don't have to strive to be on the rooftop pool and take a picture to show everybody, or to have a cocktail and take a picture of our feet next to the cocktail, or we don't have to like party with the Chili Peppers in order to be like, oh, I'm like validated or cool. You know, like we could just be dirtbags. We could just be like eating ketchup packets and, you know, like reading a book and stuffing the book crumbles into our jacket that's falling apart and using that as loft to keep us warm. And then in the morning, burning that paper book to heat up our coffee. It's so simple. And I love that part of our community is based off of the dirtbag. I'm not a dirtbag. I want to be a dirtbag. I think it's a glamorous, not glamorous, it's the opposite of glamorous, but you know, I think it's such a cool thing that we don't have to strive to just keep on making more, looking cooler, having a bigger place, a bigger car, a nicer car, all that stuff. It's pretty simple. We move our bodies. We come together as a community. We challenge our minds. We get outside. I love all that. And that's part of the answer to what you were asking earlier, like what is climbing given us?
So why do you think humans overcomplicate climbing and life? Do we have this innate desire to find problems when there are none? Or that we think life is a little too good and we gotta fuck it up somehow?
Love it. That's such a big question, right?
Yeah.
We do too, right? We always want to find some problems as climbers. Because if you took me to AVP and you told me if life is all about success, just climb the yellows and the reds, which are like, I don't know, what is that? V negative?
Yellow would be VB and red is V0 to V2, V1.
Yeah. It would be like, oh, if it's all about success, then let's just climb yellows and reds, which are like the easiest. They're like ladders, right? But then it's not all about success, because if you start touching a black route, which is, I don't know, V4 or 5 or something like that they say, yeah. I'm guessing, then your friends could say, oh, but don't you just want to get to the top? If you do the black, then you actually might fall and you might fail. And then you say, well, but I want to try it, but you might fail. Don't you want to just get to the top and succeed? Like, no, I want to try this black. And so you might fall. And actually there's so much beauty in falling. There's so much beauty in failure, you know, at least to me.
So. Yeah. I would say that the counterpoint to that, like the wanting to party with the Chili Peppers to me in climbing is constantly, okay, well, I climbed a 512. Now I got to climb a 512B. I got to find, you know, just the constant grade chasing. And I would say that my counter argument to your AVP thing is if I can go in and climb yellows and reds and be happy doing it, then there's no reason to go further if you don't want to. And I think that for me, it's just a thing that I've had to go through. Like I got into climbing. I thought everybody I knew was grade chasing. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, that was what made it fun for them was to keep pushing grades.
Yeah.
And I thought that that's what I had to do. But I, you know, Emily says that you have great body awareness. I'm the exact opposite. Like I have no idea where my body is in space. And I'm also a big
we
dude.
We keep it so. Real here.
Yeah. I mean, so when I studied theater in college and I acted a little bit and the director would tell me like, do this with your hands or whatever. And I'm like, that's what I just did with my hands. Mm-hmm. And I still get that. Like my buddy would be like, you really need to lean more to the right when you're climbing. And I'm like, I feel like I was like almost to horizontal. And he's like, you were basically standing upright. And I'm like, okay, I have no idea what I'm doing. So, and then it took me a while to just dissolve down to the fact that I'm, you know, I'm trying to push my grades, but the most important thing to me is to be having fun.
Yeah. I like
that,
it.
And I think that the biggest thing about climbing is that we can exist in the same space. Someone could be like, I'm trying to climb 515 by the time I'm 20. And I'm like, I'm just hoping to climb until I'm 60 and just have fun doing it. And if I never get above V0, such is life. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think we're all on we're all on a big spectrum, a bigger gradient, you know? So someone climbing 512 or 513 is weak sauce to Adamandra and those guys that climb 514 and 15. Those are that's just breakfast, you know? That's just a 513A. Some people will free solo that stuff. I'm not even close to I'm a toy to these guys, you know? But it's so cool because we're all on this spectrum and we could all play within our zones and we could all, so few sports could be where you really root on everybody.
Basically. Plus, you could sit down with Adamandra and be talking about the issue that you're struggling with on your project. And he could be talking about the issue that he's struggling with on his project. And it's just climbing. We're all struggling with the same issues. It's just on a grander scale as you go up.
So. Yeah. I think one of my buddies, or Ryan, who I was just climbing with a couple years, 2 years ago, we were climbing at Sitting Bull. I think that's New Mexico. Is that what it's called, Emily? Do you know what that spot, Sitting Bull?
I do not.
Okay. It's right next to Last Chance. I think it's called Sitting Bull. Beautiful place. It's like an old prehistoric, like a waterfall or something like that, that turned into rock climbing now. But he was working at that time, he was working like a 10, 5'10 something. And I was just so stoked for him. And I could see the fear in his eyes and he was afraid to like go to the next clip because he would whip pretty far. And I was just totally cheering him on. And later on, he was like, man, it's so cool. You're working like way higher grades than me, but like, you're so stoked. I'm like, yeah, of course. Cause it's the same thing. I'm working this grade that's an arbitrary number. And that's the difficult part. And like, I'm stoked when you guys cheer me on for that. And you're working this other grade at this point. Of course, it's going to move and slide on a scale later on. But like, I could see, like, you're just like me when I'm on that, my project, where we all have our own projects. It's so cool. So it's easy for me to get stoked for people that are climbing their 5'8s or 9s or 10s, anything, because they're facing the same thing I am. And then, you know, the climbers that are climbing 14s, 13s, 14s, and 15s, they could look at me the same way, like, wow, you're climbing way lower grade than me, but I could see that you're stoked for it.
That's awesome. And I'm lucky enough, the group of people I climb with, they're all better climbers than I am, but we're all on the same frequency. Like, just everybody cheers everybody on, you know?
So. Yeah. And it's so natural. It's so easy. It's almost so easy that we want to share our beta all the time. We can't hold it back because we love help. You know, like, we love sharing and our community and wanting people to get to the top that in our community that we love. That we can't even hold it back sometimes.
And I think part of that also is you are connecting literally and figuratively with the rock and the route. And so when you see someone else on it, your stoke is high because you're flashing back to maybe a memory or two or 10 that you have, a struggle where you had a breakthrough, and it does. It gets your stoke high. We've actually, Jeremy has a really good following on Instagram and he gets a lot of unsolicited beta in a variety of subjects. So, and as a woman, I do too. And I've had a handful of confrontations for it, but I really enjoy your take on why one would like to share beta. And that's probably the most kind and gentle, disposition I've ever heard about it. So thanks for sprinkling that in. Really?
Got it. That's a good point. Yeah.
And I would say that sharing beta with your friends, if you're, you know, everybody's on board with that, go for it. Like, me and my friends just spray each other down with beta constantly, but no one cares. And if they do, they get angry and you don't do it. You know what I mean? Like, and no one's pissed. It's just like, shut up now. I'm trying to figure this out.
Yeah.
And you're telling me stuff that's not, I'm not doing.
So like kind of that part of growth, I think, in communication where they say someone's spraying you down with beta and you kind of need to learn sometimes to say like, oh dude, thanks, but I'm good for right now. I'm trying to figure it out. And it's really similar with COVID, right? Like, if someone wants to come up to you and give you a hug and you're not at that point where you're comfortable giving them a hug on the crag, it happens a lot, then I think it's a development point to feel comfortable in your own skin to express how you feel, which sounds super easy, but for a lot of people, like, it takes, you know, I don't know, it's sometimes it's hard to express like, hey, oh, actually I'm holding off right now. Like I'm still pretty COVID cautious and that's it. Just be able to say it versus letting them hug you and then looking back and feeling like, oh man, I should have said something. And it's just like spring beta.
So on that topic, actually, Emily and I were having a discussion before we started the podcast. How has it been for you out at the Green Belt? And because I was saying that when we were at McKinney, almost everybody was wearing masks, climbers. Mm-hmm. And if they walked by, they're putting their t-shirt over their mouth. Wow. If that does anything, who knows? And everybody's pretty cool about it. Because I'm, you know, I live with my wife who has asthma, and then my mother-in-law also lives with me. So I'm super cautious, and I've only been climbing basically with one other person, and he's just as much of a hermit as I am. And so, you know, we'd go out and we're buddies and we'd both be wearing masks, even though I knew he was 99% safe. So, but how has it been for sport climbers out there?
It seems more casual than what you described in regards to most people aren't wearing masks, but most people are more than 6 feet apart in a very spacious area outdoors, so the ventilation shouldn't be a problem. I'm pretty meticulous about following up with journal and data entry and stuff about COVID. I also do medical stuff, so I actually get journals fed to me that I select and I choose, and COVID is one of the topics. But I haven't felt any imminent danger that's not gonna make it, so that's not worth it for me to climb. I do think that most of the community and my buddies think I'm more of one of the strictest about COVID precautions. My position and my take would be, hey, if I could take an extra precaution and it's easy to do it and it doesn't annoy the hell out of me, then do it. So that means sanitizing between routes. Is it gonna break me to put on some sanitizer and rub my hands? Like, no. Is it gonna break me to stick with the same two or three climbers the entire time? Like, no. Now, saying that, having said that, sometimes my two or three climbers aren't there, Francis or Andrew or something like that, and I might go on a one-off and blame somebody else, but that doesn't mean I blame them all the time. That's my take on it. It's like I go to HEB sometimes, but I don't go there every single day for 8 hours.
Yeah. So. And it's just, I mean, I think one of the things about COVID is and you probably know more about it than I do, but there's just not a lot of data to support what's good and what's bad. I mean, we know wear masks, be outside, be 6 feet apart. But then after that, it's like, it's all these incidental interactions that freak me out. You know, when you're just walking past somebody on a trail, is that bad? Is it good? Is it okay? You know, what's the risk there? But then the other thing is, I think everybody has to figure out what risk they're willing to take.
For sure. So. For sure. I feel like the risks, I scrutinize a lot of stuff in regards to COVID, I think, and I'm more safe than most of my climbing buddies. But if I, at this point, get COVID, I'm pretty comfortable with having tried what I wanted to try. You know, I also feel like relatively young, pretty healthy and stuff like that. So that type of, some of my family and friends have asked me like, why are you even worried about this stuff? Like, you're like one of the greatest candidates to get COVID and just survive it. And like, you know, probably not even have symptoms, but there's also the unknown of potentially long-term effects, you know, mental and cardiac and pulmonary, you know.
And I don't understand why more people aren't talking about the long haul.
Well, we don't know. I mean, I do. My smell and taste, I got it in March.
Right.
So yeah, your smell and taste, but have you had any other side effects?
Well, what I was going to say is it's only back about, I would say 50, 60%. So I, as a chef and an ex barista, I used to, you know, taste espresso. I used to taste wine when I drank. And so I would be able to taste those subtle nuances, but I cannot taste the subtleties anymore. I can taste, you know, everything. But for example, cilantro was a huge no for me. It tastes like soap, like my whole, like the smell, it on my cutting board, I would never omit it from a dish, but I don't eat it. Like even the speck, now I can withstand it. I can handle it.
Here I am. I love it. But yeah.
Yeah. For me, it's that's my residual. And then I consider what it could be. And yeah. I've smelled and tasted for 33 years. So if it's knocked down to only 60-50%, then I feel very fortunate.
And I do. Thankfully you're not having any of these other things like strokes and, you know, people are having, you know, like lung issues that are just not clearing up and no one knows how to treat yet. And
correct.
So that's the part that scares me. Even at 45 and being overweight, and I'm like, yeah, I'm a good candidate to maybe not survive. But then what happens afterwards? That's the part that I don't want to find out about.
I'm with you. That's one of the reasons why I feel pretty strict about it, because we just don't know. And the reason why we don't know is because we're talking about long-term stuff.
Yep.
And
we don't have long-term data.
We don't have that data.
But we know, I mean, some of the studies, whatever. Some of the studies have shown people after around 61 or 71 days still have symptoms, something like 30 to 40% of people of all age ranges. But that's like, you know, one study, so kind of just feel it out. But then there's also the original SARS, which some people, I think like 20, 30% of the people still have like pulmonary issues after 3 years. So it's not life or death. It's not newsworthy in a way that you could say, because it's not dying. But it's
not dying, but we're also talking about like marathon runners who can't walk up a flight of stairs without being completely out of breath. And I guess my question, and like I said, everybody has to assess their own thing, but for me, it's just like, is it worth going through that for the rest of my life just to go climb outside?
Well, you very well could have already had it.
I could have. And I could have, yeah. I mean, it's very possible.
The like ambiguity else of it is...
I feel like everybody else in the world, I play that, like, do I have a sinus infection or do I got the COVID? You know what I mean? Like, you know.
And like, is it worth it, right? It's such a good question. And it's different for everybody. But now that the winter's coming in, I'm wondering if the rain is going to come for sure. And so I think I've accepted that I am going to go back to Crux for the first time because I've never even been there since then. I think it's worth it for me because my physical health and my mental health and my community and stuff will be there. And I think that will, and I also know that they're doing a really good job and 20% capacity and stuff like that. So I think it's worth it, all things considered. I'm also not, I don't have any, my mom or my parents, no one old or no one that is at risk. So that changes. I'll put myself at risk for, I don't think I'm going to die at all. I'm not worried about that, but I'm more worried about like what Emily's going through a little bit of, you know?
For sure. Yeah.
And the breathing and the brain fogginess and the cardiac and pulmonary stuff.
Yeah. It was March 16th when I first had symptoms, and then March 18th was when my taste and smell were gone and I had dry cough and fatigue and occasional fever, but I had been in Vegas at a concert, 3-day concert with like 5,000 people. So when I heard about the potential, of being a silent carrier, I told my friend Vivian that I was going to go home. I didn't want to stay in Vegas in her home because I could have gotten her sick. And thank goodness I didn't stay at her place, because upon coming home, Brian and I quarantined together because I thought that I could be sick. And I told him like, look, you should quarantine yourself because I'm pretty sure that I'm sick, but my doctor wouldn't admit that it could be COVID because everyone was so, you know, don't say it's COVID, it's a sinus infection. And I did not get a test, but I did test positive for antibodies in June.
Oh, wow.
And I had, And so I had a friend who's an ER doctor, and he kind of gave us a timeline of what to do. And it did have some comfort. Or did give me some comfort, but the thing that I know it sounds terrible, but I just thought, out of all the shit that I've done in my life, and as a mountain climber and a rock climber, this is going to take me out. Like this thing. And I just see the pain that everyone's going through. And I look forward to when we can hug and embrace each other without having to ask. The people that we're comfortable with, excuse me, you should always ask to hug someone if you don't know them. Let me just specify that.
This little bit of a side of me that also, I think, do you guys ever listen to Training Beta podcast?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Neely Quinn.
What's her name again?
Neely Quinn.
Harry Quinn. But I think she was interviewing, not Eric Horst, but Steve Bechtel.
Okay.
And I think this is the beginning of the pandemic. I really like Steve Bechtel. Everything he says tends to make sense to me. And he said what I believe, which is he said he thinks that there's a lot of things that can be fruitful or beneficial from the pandemic, and just that we could gain a lot from kind of going through rough times again, kind of not having access to everything again, and kind of just realizing that we have so much already. And I like that. I like that. I like that it's made it a little bit difficult. It's almost like, I don't know if it's like a samurai or ninja, but like you could have deprivations and still learn to appreciate a lot of things, you know? So like, I remember this is off the side, I think, but I remember seeing this commercial from like, I think it was like TGI Fridays restaurant. And they're like, you know, this burger, this cheeseburger, and this steak filet, like get what you want when you want it. And I was like, huh, that's an interesting phrase. Of course, everyone's going to catch on to that.
Very American phrase.
Very American phrase. But what if you said, I'm going to give you something. It's not exactly what you want, but it's still a pretty tasty meal. And I'm going to make you wait 30 minutes. Can you still enjoy that? Or do you really need the number one thing that you want right now? Not number two. You need it right now when you want it. And so anyways, I think it's like, oh, get what you want when you want it. Like, no, actually, I could learn a lot. And I could learn a lot from not getting what I want when I want it.
I was going to say, I think it was a couple of weeks into the pandemic when I realized how soft we are.
Oh, yeah.
Like, when you couldn't get exactly what you wanted from the grocery store, I was just irritated. Like, why can't I get what I want? Like,
see, but then people like me, chefs by trade, and I consider myself an intelligent person, my fight or flight went on. And I just thought, what can I do with what I have? And how can I work with what's in front of me and deal with what's not?
Oh, yeah. And I had food to eat, don't get me wrong, but if I wanted to get like a frozen pizza, like my favorite brand or whatever, and it wasn't in stock, that was just kind of irritating because you've just gotten used to the fact that you just bomb into the store and grab that frozen pizza and throw it in the oven. You know what I mean? And you know, Vince was saying that he goes to HEB. Well, we don't, we order everything and we get curbside. And even if you remember at the beginning of the pandemic, you'd have to order curbside like 2 weeks in advance and you might get 50% of your order, right? So we couldn't even just, and even now we just still do curbside. So it's not even like I can go, hey, it's 9:41. I feel like having a frozen pizza. I'm just going to bomb over to HEB. No, I could put on a mask if HEB is open. I don't know if they're staying open this late anymore, but I'm not going into places like that by choice to protect my family. So I can't even do that. And there was part of me that took a long time to get used to that. It's not that I didn't have food to eat. It's just that I was so used to just having whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted, just like you were saying. And yeah, I think there's something good about that. And then for me, it's just like, I was already an introvert anyway. So it's just like becoming more self-contained has been pretty awesome. So I don't know if that's going to be good for my mental health, but it's been great.
When you spin it back to climbing, like, lot of climbing, we can't just get what we want when we want it.
Sure. You know?
Like we all want to climb stronger and we want to climb to the top and send and stuff like that, but like it makes us respect it, you know. Sure. We have our good days and then we're so excited. I remember maybe like 2 weeks ago our buddies Pavan and Daniel and we were all stoked because the weather was like sending temperatures, you know. And we all went out there and we all got demolished by the rock or none of us sent anything. Yep. And it's just, we can't get what we want all the time. But can you still appreciate that part? Can you still appreciate that journey? Can you still appreciate that brand of pizza, frozen pizza that's good, but not the one that you.
Sure. Sure.
Same for me, you know.
The best
is when we're at restaurants right now that are have the outdoor patios. So like I can't get everything that I want, but man, I sure can enjoy it when I kind of just stop to think about it, or hopefully not even have to think about it too much anymore. Just appreciate it for.
Yeah. There's definitely those times in climbing when you train and then you go on a trip and then it rains or you just get shut down and you're like, well, I'm not coming back to Waco for another 6 months. So I
man, Jeremy, just hearing that hurts me. As much as I want to say, like, yeah, for sure, I could just enjoy the hiking a little bit in the rain and stuff like that. Like, oof, that would still be a tough one for me.
Yeah, I mean, if you go with friends, and it's still like a fun trip, but
yeah. Exactly. But one thing that's kind of cool about it is that you'll always kind of remember it.
Oh, for sure.
Like, for Thanksgiving, we weren't sure if we went to Sam's Throne and Mountain Magazine in Arkansas, 10 hours away, not too far from Horseshoe Canyon. But the temperatures and the weather looked pretty crappy, and we were all kind of toying with the idea of maybe staying and going to Reimers, which we love, but I would never remember it because it's just another 100 or 200 times I've been to Reimers. And I love it, but it's just kind of cool to, like, even if we went to Sam's Throne and Mountain Magazine and it rained out and we had a hike, I would remember that. And so it's kind of cool to have that ability to enjoy something new, but also enjoy something that's not new.
I would say in every case when there's been a question about whether or not we should go, like, it's usually E-Rock. Like, should we go? It's raining in Austin. Is it raining in Fredericksburg? And plus it's granite, so you can climb on it when it's wet.
Right.
So I'm just like, let's just go and we'll find out. What's the worst case scenario? We eat lunch in Fredericksburg and then turn around and drive home? Can't be that bad.
I like it, Jeremy.
Same thing with Waco. Just drive out there. I mean, it sucks. The drive sucks. But 9.5 hours. But
for some reason, I thought it was 6 something hours. But all right.
No, it's 9.5. Actually, it's only an hour more to go to Horseshoe Canyon.
Okay.
So, yeah. Except when you go out to Waco, you go into the mountain time. So you get an hour back, theoretically.
Yeah, you do.
All right.
Well, yeah. So I don't know if you know, we do shout outs at the end of our show. And I just want to know if there was anything that you were super pumped about or an area that you want to promote or a brand that you're super into. If none of the above, that's totally fine too.
Yeah, gosh, I don't think I'm connected the same way that a lot of people that you've interviewed are that way.
Do you have anything that you want to just promote in general, like a cause or something that you believe in, anything our world's going through?
I think some of my friends that I climb with, I just really like the way that they're just so stoked for everybody. And I think you guys are probably surrounding yourselves around similar type of people. And I think the world of them, you know, like, they make my world, you know. I guess one way I've thought about it before is that I thought climbing is, like, so amazing in itself. But I also realized, but the community, I think, is also really important too. So here's what I imagine. I imagine we all go to Reimers. I go to Reimers. There's no crowds. No one's there. Everything's on auto belay. So I have all the routes as much as I want to myself. Like, guess what? After like an hour or two, I'd start getting bored of it. Or say a weekend or 2 weekends or 3 weekends of just going out there by myself on auto belay. Like, I can't do that. Like, I need my community, you know, our community, you know. But by the same token, if you want to say, oh, it's all about the community, then I don't know if you guys have gone through this phase before, but I used to just go out to the bars in Austin all the time, right? And if you told me, okay, well, it's all about the community, let's get all your climbing buddies and go to the bar every single night. Like, no, that's cool, but I need climbing. I need climbing for sure. You can't just send me to the bar with them or even to their house and just drink beer every single, you know, Tuesday, Thursday, and weekend, because that's when I climb. So I definitely know that it's a combination of both, but I'm going to give credit to both the climbing and my community for sure, because the climbing cannot be that amazing without them, you know? And I think we all have that crew that we've built and we've fostered to, you know, and all those relationships in between. I guess that would be my shout out, because I don't have any brands or any specific crags that, you know, are mine. Or
I mean, the genuine shout out. I love it. It's very true. you paint a very interesting picture with what you just said in regards to if you had just this robo belayer with you, no crowd, an hour, 90 minutes, and then just kind of turning around and nobody there. That's not climbing to me. That's why I have a hard time even just like hanging out on auto belays in the gym by myself.
Yeah, I'm imagining in Germany, like if you're outdoors at Waco and the entire floor was crash pads and you're like, oh, I could walk up anywhere at this point, you know? But
I'm an introvert, so
it might
balance. I'm kind of on board with it.
cool.
But I was going to say, like, if you're still climbing with your friends now, then it's less of an issue than I've had. Whereas I had this crew of people and we would go out every weekend. And of course, everybody just stopped hanging out with each other because we weren't going out in a big group anymore to go climbing. And so we kind of all lost touch. And now I'm trying to reel some of those people back in. It's been kind of an interesting thing where you realize, okay, yes, we are climbing friends with the emphasis on climbing and then friends. And that's been kind of interesting too, because, you know, at the beginning of the year we spent, you know, Saturday and Sunday together every weekend and plus times in the gym, and then all of a sudden, you know, nothing. And we started off, you know, we're doing Zoom calls and, you know, like little virtual happy hours, and then of course everybody's just gone their separate ways and doing their own thing and trying to survive this in their own way, and I understand that. But yeah. So it's been kind of interesting to have a climbing crew at this time. So
yeah, and it'll evolve, you know.
Sure,
it keeps evolving.
I think some of my friends have taken the opportunity to be like, okay, it's time to move somewhere else, which they're all, because they're all in their mid-20s, and it's been weird for me because I'm in my mid-40s and I'm like, well, why is everybody moving away? And I'm like, oh yeah, because that's what I did when I was in my mid-20s as well. I moved from Michigan to Austin to New York and then back to Austin. So
for sure.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Vince, so much again for being willing to be a guest on our podcast. It's been a pleasure having you today.
Thanks so much for having me. And nice meeting you, Jeremy, finally.
Yeah, nice to meet you too, man.
All right, everyone. Well, that is all that we have for our episode number 26 today, featuring Vincent Pham. We look forward to having y'all join us again next time.
Bye.